Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. Today, we are discussing political apostasy. Oh, and I guess I should introduce all of us because I think people mentioned on the episode last time, people who don't normally listen to us, I noticed that they didn't know who was saying what.
I enfolded myself into the other boys as per your instructions.
That's what happened. No, okay, so it's Chris is here. That's me. Jason is here. Say hi, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
And then the remaining voice is Ben's.
Yeah, I'm the laughter.
Yeah.
I'm the laugh track.
And today we're going to discuss why we decided to leave the left. No, I'm just kidding. We are talking about people who did decide to leave the left. I think we're talking about the concept of political apostasy in general and focusing on people who left the left. In fact, most of the stuff that we read is about political apostasy in one direction because there isn't a lot in the other direction.
It's hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like when I was a child and my parents were conservative Christians, I was like, yeah, that's what I am too. But then I became like 16 and started listening to punk rock and I stopped doing that, you know?
Right.
So I guess I'm a political apostate in the other direction.
Well, by that definition, the three of us are pure apostates.
Yeah.
Right. To find political apostates of this caliber, but toward the left as opposed to the right, you would have to basically be reading the accounts of Hungarian and Polish and German former fascists in the People's Republics.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was like 1950 and you were trying to figure out like, oh, this my professor or this teacher, this cop used to be a fascist but is now a communist instead. Short of that, I just, you know, there are few for a reason, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the Legion of the Archangel Michael was pretty much absorbed wholesale into the Romanian Communist Party after World War II.
Whoa.
Because the Romanian Communist Party was willing to cleanse a lot of people of their sins in order to be able to function properly. Yeah. Also, the Romanian Communist Party was probably one of the most, if not the most, conservative. There we go. Conservative of the Communist Parties in the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah, Varn will appreciate your distinction there.
I mean, I just use it on accident because as a person who was raised as a stupid leftist, I would use those terms interchangeably because, you know, I was raised not to have nuance.
Right.
Right.
And it turns out that the difference matters kind of a lot.
Yes, it does.
Big time.
God, look at that long-ass gray hair that must belong to somebody that's not me.
You got to leave that in. We're all gray hairs here.
Yeah, we are.
I'm very happy about it, even.
We're all on the cusp of 40.
Now that I'm a dad, I guess I should just pretty much just stop giving a shit about all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So just be a dad. Just be a dad. Embrace it, man.
Exactly.
Yeah. Start wearing white New Balances and voting Republican, you know.
You're a silver fox who listens to all the punk bands you're not supposed to.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Speaking of reactionaries, you like my J.R.R. Tolkien shirt?
Yeah, he's a real one. Yeah. But he was moving away from the anti-clerical, right, that he witnessed. He was like, I don't want anything to do with that, so I'm going to go be with these guys and think
about it. This was an overcorrection against anti-clericalism. But anyway, moving on from that, he never was an apostate.
True.
Like the people who we will... And, you know, actually...
A lot of the apostates we'll talk about today actually have that as a major feature of their shift toward the right.
Right.
Was their revulsion and disgust with the anti-religious atmosphere of the left.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and also a corollary of the phenomenon of political apostasy, which in and of itself is not unlike religious conversion, is an actual religious conversion.
Yeah.
and the, you know, the examples of Whitaker Chambers comes to
right.
You have figures like Reinhold Niebuhr who are already straddling.
But Ben, this is kind of your idea for an episode. And I would like for you to kind of just give us a little intro as to why you thought this is something that we should talk about. Like, what was your thought process behind bringing this up, of coming up with this idea for an episode?
Yeah, explain yourself.
Yes. Right now before God and man.
I have a longstanding fascination with this. I think actually going back to, you brought up the personal, Chris, but like, I was very much brought up in a conservative household as an evangelical. My grandfather, as I've mentioned a while back, was an evangelist. And so I often find myself having sort of internal monologues or dialogues with him, maybe, or with what I come from, sort of trying to find things that have remained, things that have remained intact from those years, and things that have been jettisoned. Trying to find the sort of the way into things like the gospel, to things like presumed conservative ideological identifications, finding them mirrored in strange ways in my communism many years later. And that's just been an ongoing fascination. You know, I sent you guys this in response to the outline question you made for Jason about why we're doing this, why this even matters, why this is of any significance. And if I can read that paragraph I sent you, maybe, I think there's something particularly telling about our political landscape as a whole in these stories of lost faith, betrayal, defection, and heroic self-criticism. And I think that perhaps the fault lines of axiomatic beliefs and those who fall through them to the other side can be seen as a kind of dialectical mirror, as I mentioned, in which the left sees itself in the right's reflection and vice versa. So that's kind of why I'm fascinated with this. I also think we have to complicate this idea of just out and out betrayal and opportunism.
Right.
Because that's just too flat, and it doesn't explain anything. You know, it doesn't, there is a lot of insight that can come from examining why people can't hold the line anymore and why they make conscientious decisions to betray everything they've been committed to and all of their comrades when the stakes are the highest. Like, some of these figures are doing this when the stakes are very, very high, right? The 30s and the 40s. I think that's just to get us started. I think there's a lot to be learned by examining this phenomenon. As leftists, obviously the right thinks the very same. The way that these ex-Trotskyists were absorbed into the ranks, they were prized, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah, and really, for me, this is the first time that I've ever actually really put this level of thought into it, because what we should be discussing anyways is somewhat different from how, someone like, what's his name? Norman Podhoretz.
Yeah.
He was just trying to find a new way to matter, you know, just to find some other angle to fulfill his self. You know, like Christopher Lash talks about that a lot, especially in the culture of narcissism, the kind of the shift in the 1970s. And I think that's a different phenomenon, actually kind of a very significantly different phenomenon from an entirely like an ex-communist as opposed to a former leftist. And the distinction is great. And in my mind, I kind of just always lump them all together. And I really don't think they should be.
There's a line of demarcation that I think is the right that begins with the new left, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the new left, political apostates are leaving the left for the same reasons they got involved in the left, and that is like personal fulfillment and like it's psychological reasons. And it seems like the ex-communists and former Trotskyists who leave the old left are doing it out of just like utter disillusionment and like demoralization with what the project turned into.
Right.
And that's another thing Lash talks a lot about in The Culture of Narcissism, is the whole therapeutic nature of people's involvement in the left. And it's actually something we've talked about a lot, is like the way that we the way that we as leftists use our activism and our involvement in the left as a way of like easing the pain of reality, rather than actually having like goals and strong beliefs of how the world should be ordered and how we and ideas about how to change it.
I mean, this comes from the mouth of, or from the pen of Irving Kristol in that article you sent Jason from his memoirs of a Trotskyist, when he's so yeah, like this disillusionment with the new left is very prominent. And he says, what I have seen of student radicalism on various campuses over the past dozen years baffles and bothers me. It seems to be more a psychological than a truly political phenomenon. There is a desperate quest for self-identity, an evident and acute involvement of one's political beliefs with all kinds of personal anxieties and neuroses, a consequent cheerlessness and truculence. And I told you guys, I think he was onto something there. There's like, that's
he absolutely is.
Like there's a, okay. So the new left is its own thing. I think we will have to lay out, like you said, and distinguish between the apostates that are leaving the party or leaving the Fourth International in the, you know, before World War II and after, and later when you get to sort of the Horowitzes in the new left.
Yeah.
These are different phenomena, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I want to make it clear, I feel like I need to leave more disclaimers and things that I say now, just because people just are
love to misunderstand.
I think that a lot of people really look for reasons to misunderstand. And just for the sake of covering my own ass here, these are, as far as the phenomenon, the general phenomenon is concerned, there seems to be like more personal reasons within the new left and more disillusionment with the project in the old left. Clearly there are going to be exceptions to those rules, but this is as a generalizable phenomenon. Like if we're talking about a majority of the cases that we came across in our readings, and it hasn't just been observed by us. This is like what Christopher Lash talks about. He talks about like the way that a lot of these radicals, like the most radicals from the 1960s and 70s, ended up becoming like grifters of another sort. And generally, a lot of them became like, libertarian gurus. And some of them move on to the right and become like business owners and involved in, become political apostates of the ilk that we're talking about. Most of the people that we're talking about, the reason we know about them is because they became pundits or involved in the State Department or, people of stature. There are, of course, going to be thousands of people of no stature whose accounts that we haven't read about, right?
Right.
Right. I mean, because what we're talking about is an element. It's a valence. It's a part of a bigger historical trajectory. So if you think that we have been kind of onto something when we're talking about the difference between the old left and the new left, the difference between the pre and post neoliberal world, the proletarian movement and its spectacleized, kind of recuperated copycat, if that all makes sense, then this also should, because this is just part of that.
Right.
I feel like to maybe circle back to, or to begin situating ourselves, because I know we're going to be a lot more familiar with the neocons that come out of the new left, maybe, or a lot of our listeners will be. But to go back to...
Any who's anybody who grew up in the 90s or the 2000s and witnessed the war on terror, you're going to be familiar with the neocons who used to be leftists, generally former trots.
Yeah.
So our last episode, we were talking about the third campist position over history. And that actually relates quite a lot to this discussion because a lot of the people that we were reading or reading adjacently about, like James Burnham or Max Shackman, they're going to be, you know, Burnham is one of those who breaks away from the Fourth International, right? Before and very briefly is in that organization before basically making the move, the beginnings of the move across the ideological Rubicon. And so this, the Fourth International and the opposition, there is a genealogy there, that is made, that is laid out for us later in the kind of histories of neoconservatism. But those are somewhat different. The Max Shackmans, the James Burnhams, the Sidney Hooks.
Well, yeah, like if you read The Managerial Revolution, for example, James Burnham and his ilk, his generation, and that kind of ex-leftist, that kind of ex-communist, is a higher and a altogether different caliber compared to like the neocons that were once, you know, they were like student radicals in the 60s that became neocons in the 80s. The difference is so profound that it's like a shame to group them together too much. Anyways, obviously there's an overlap. There's a similar phenomenon, but the distinction should definitely be made that we're talking about two entirely different orders of magnitude.
Yes. But there's also the different journeys, right? Like, so not every ex-communist who becomes an apostate in that sense towards liberal democracy goes so far as Shackman or Burnham or Hook or Chambers. You have Max Eastman. Right. You have John Dos Passos. You have some of the writers in the Touchstone book, The God That Failed. André Gide, Arthur Koestler, like Ignacio Silón, Stephen Spender. Richard Wright, they don't all become, they don't all become rightists. So
I want to mention George Orwell as one of these people as well, who never quits being a self-proclaimed socialist, but aligns himself so solidly with the anti-communists that he might as well have, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because of his, you know, the Stalinists tried to kill him in the Spanish Civil War. He didn't like that very much.
Right.
And, became a hardcore anti-Stalinist that ended up, during the British version of the Red Scare, he ended up informing on his former comrades.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's the genealogy. That's the trajectory of the anti-communist left moving into kind of the Red Scare, and then some of them come out on the other side of the aisle, in the largest meaning of that phrase. But also, the Stalinists effectively killed the leader of the opposition, right? Orwell fought with the POUM in the Spanish Civil War. He was adjacent to Trotskyists on the battlefield. So a lot of these people contend that it is their fidelity to their radical politics that sends them into these different orbits. And that they never they never actually jettison those beliefs. They just find themselves in a whole different company of people.
Yeah, the Isaac Deutscher essay kind of deals with this phenomenon very well. Like, I actually really like this a whole lot. It says, the Holy Alliance freed Europe from Napoleon's oppression, and for a moment its victory was hailed by most Europeans. Yet, what Castlereagh and Metternich and Alexander I had to offer a liberated Europe was merely the preservation of an old decomposing order. Thus, the abuses and the aggressiveness of an empire bred by the revolution gave a new lease on life to European feudalism. this was the ex-Jacobin's most unexpected triumph. But the price that he paid for it, that he presently, he himself and in his anti-Jacobin cause, looked like vicious, ridiculous anachronisms. In the year of Napoleon's defeat, Shelley wrote to Wordsworth, "In honored poverty, thy voice did weave, songs consecrate to truth and liberty. Deserting these, thou leavest me to grieve, thus having been, that thou shouldest cease to be." And if our ex-communist had any historical sense, he would ponder this lesson.
Yeah. That's really good.
What's that from?
That's from the Deutscher.
Deutscher, yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
That's from the ex-communist conscience.
Yeah, well, these are all the stuff that we read, I'll be in the show notes.
So the just to mention, the ex-communist's conscience was a book review of The God That Failed, which was right. that gathering of ex-communists basically confessing, explaining, providing insight to the anti-communist, liberals and right wing, who were trying to gain insight into why does communism have any attraction. And they were very highly prized testimonies to that establishment.
Now, do you want to just start with different iterations right now? Just like go into that.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't mention far-right conspiranoia, but I think that there's enough stuff to talk about here that like that might come into play whenever we talk about the neocons.
The
right?
Neocons. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, especially that article you shared, Jason, on what is it? It's like the Trotskyite, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize I was reading. I kind of deduced from the Occidental Quarterly or whatever, but I didn't realize that I was reading basically a pseudo-paleo-conservative criticism.
Yeah, you used to kind of encounter that kind of stuff a lot in the kind of Alex Jones adjacent part of the anti-war movement. And like right after high school, I would encounter these people on a regular basis, and they would be like, "You know that Paul Wolfowitz is a Trotskyist," and that was supposed to be like somehow a
gotcha. Yeah.
Like they would say things like, "Ah, you're a Trotskyist. You know who else is a Trotskyist? Paul Wolfowitz."
Okay, so
who says that right now is Alexander Dugin.
Let's save that for that section.
Oh, right.
Okay, so there are different iterations of this phenomenon, defections from the left, which is only natural that people are going to defect from the cause to when it flounders, whenever. There are hardships, you're going to have people leaving. But I think what's interesting about this is the way that people go from being partisans of the left to partisans of the right.
Yeah.
So, and it's not always for opportunist reasons.
No.
Especially in the older iterations.
Yeah, Deutscher talks about that too. The difference between the ex-communist who like first came around like in the wake of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
Versus those who joined, because of or in the Stalin era.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
The difference, there's like such a profound difference, because what we're really talking about is, he says, typically the pedagogical pretensions of the ex-communist men of letters seem grossly exaggerated. Most of them never actually spent any time in the movement. And, just think about what I said before. James Burnham was a guy who I think it's in Toledo. Yeah. He was in a group. And he led that group, and that group led a major strike.
Yeah.
So James Burnham was a person who commanded the respect of workers in struggle.
Right.
And the difference between that and forget the neocons, but even just the people who wrote The God That Failed, and the difference between like someone like that and someone like something Spender.
Stephen Spender. He was an English poet and critic who was in the Communist Party.
Comparing Burnham to a wiener like Horowitz, right?
Yeah. It's night and day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember when we saw Horowitz speak in Austin?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we basically like were part of a counter protest, but we sat
and somebody threw a pie and hit him in the face, and there's no telling who it was.
I was going to ask if there was a cream pie.
Yeah. but yeah, we saw him speak, and he's just a little fucking wiener. Like I just I wanted to shove him into his locker so bad, you know.
Yeah, like, you know, like Max Schachtman is still somebody who I would read even now. Like it's his entire life's work is worth contending with. Yeah. Even the stuff that he wrote in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, like right towards the end of his life, you know, that's still just it's just so much more richer and so much more. It just says a lot more, you know.
Well,
there's more behind it.
It's funny to think about Horowitz collaborating with the Panthers.
Right.
It kind of makes sense that he would get the shit scared out of him, you know.
He probably got bullied and being a little like nerdy wiener white boy, and then yeah. Anyway, yeah. So like you have here on this outline, Jason, like Kronstadt, Stalin, Molotov, Ribbentrop, Hungary, and the Prague Spring, all of which are huge moments of defeat for the liberatory project of communism,
right,
in one way or another. With Kronstadt, you have the defeat of an idea of left unity and the idea that the anarchists and the Bolsheviks are going to create a new society together, and basically the realization that they're in a holding pattern to try to just stave off imperialism and fight a civil war. And that's when the revolution starts cannibalizing its own, right?
Yeah.
And then with Stalin, you get the Thermidorian reaction of the Bolshevik Revolution in place. And the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is sort of the cherry on top of that, like, cynicism and realpolitik that accompanies the initial shifting of the battle from an ideological battle to one for just existence, right?
Right. Yeah, like thousands of Black and Jewish members left the Communist Party like all at once.
Of course.
Whenever they first found out about the what is it called? The non-aggression pact.
Right. And because prior to that, the Communist Party was at the forefront of the anti-fascist movement.
Yeah.
And they made zero sense. And also, these are all the people that had been holding on to the party even after the show trials. You know? It's like, you're gonna make a pact with Hitler now?
These are the people that launched the first ever boycott, divestment, sanctions movement.
Right.
Right.
And I think you can include in there, Jason, but you didn't but this is sort of just like the culmination of all of this is the secret speech, right?
Hmm. Oh, right.
Where there's a massive round of defections where you see people like Albert Camus leaving writing his Why I Left the Left.
I mean, I don't remember the exact number, but it's something like tens of thousands of people.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that's finally when with
stops being a mass party.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
With Hungary, the Hungarian Revolution, quote unquote. And the Prague Spring is where you just see like a repressive state repressing. And at this point, it's really hard for a lot of people to have any sort of hope that the liberatory project is actually going to liberate anything. Right. And so it's understandable. Like we talked about last week with Natalia Sadova's letter, right? Like her personal feelings are understandable. And, you definitely see why a lot of people leave politics altogether.
Mm-hmm.
What still that I don't quite understand is people who become partisans of the right because they're disillusioned with how the communists are behaving in a right-wing manner, right?
Right. Right. Well, there's
what they perceive to be a right-wing manner.
There's a profound loss of faith, right?
Yeah.
Deutscher puts it really well. Nearly every ex-communist broke with his party in the name of communism.
Right.
Yeah.
That's like the key thing that can't, that we disregard at our peril, you know?
Right. And like, so the three of us are somewhat apostate in that we left the...
We left the apostates.
We left the apostates, right? We didn't just become, we didn't become like Stalinists, you know. We didn't just get absorbed wholesale into to Marxism-Leninism or anything like that. In fact, Marxist-Leninists would call us anarchists, and like former Third Campists would call us Marxist-Leninists. And
well, I was actually just, well, gather your thought, but I was just thinking about this yesterday, about the time I got involved with the ISO. It was probably 2010. I remember there was this talked about debate between Alex Kalinikos, is that his name?
Yeah,
that's him. And Zizek. And I remember how, you know, they both said their piece, and then there was a man in the audience, and he was, I think, I want to say he was Yugoslavian, or he was from the former Yugoslav Republic, and he was a communist. And because he was from there, he was a, you know, he was a Stalinist. He wasn't a Trotskyist. And he basically said something to Kalinikos, and Kalinikos corrected him. And it's like, we don't think very highly. You have to be careful about making those Stalinist points. And I just think that is totally absurd. To be still battling Stalinism after the fall of the Soviet Union is just such an absurd thing.
It's absurd for a couple of reasons. And one of those reasons is that the only time that Josip Tito actually purged the League of Yugoslav Communists was to get rid of the Stalinists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but to Kalinikos et al., state capitalism was what was held sway over Yugoslavia, which is the same as what held sway over the Soviet Union and China. And even though there are differences, the ultimately, the fact that there was worker self-management, none of that matters because there was still like this figurehead in place at the top of society. And that, you know, and there was the exploitative mechanism at the top of society, drawing off profits, etc. So like, yeah.
Well, and to some Third Campus, the fact that the entire social system was gone 30 years ago is insignificant, because right now the situation in Russia and Ukraine is still kind of Stalinism, if you think about it.
Yeah, that's what that one workers' liberty article said.
But tying that Third Camp and today's discussion together. So, what's happening? Last time when we discussed the breakup of the Fourth International and Sadova's resignation and Burnham's departure and so forth. There's a point where the moral is usurps the political or becomes the political so totally, because for understandable reasons. And I think that Kalinikos is the inheritor of that. He still cannot extract the two. The moral is still the totality to examine this entire history. And that makes sense. Why, following that path, you might wind up, you know, writing for as an editor for William F. Buckley's paper,
The National Review.
Yeah, the National Review. It makes sense if you begin to embark on that you would find yourself on the wholly opposite side when moral politics usurp all others.
Right.
I don't know if that explains at all, but I think that
no, it definitely explains part of it, because if you think that, first of all, Stalinism is just capitalism but without the democracy, then obviously the capitalism that has democracy is the better one. That, and I think that that's, the ISO talked a lot about how it wasn't, that wasn't what it was advocating. You know, it wasn't advocating that we side with Washington against Moscow. The idea was that we side with neither, it's neither Washington nor Moscow. But it, like we mentioned this like 1,000 times, the Third Camp often ended up just being in the first camp.
There's a strange parallel to the like, oh, Russia is imperialism without democracy.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
That's an aside. Right.
And when Deutsch talks about the, he's trying to save the baby by getting rid of the bathwater.
Right.
And you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
And then at a certain point, you're like, actually, you know what? Get rid of the baby also.
Yeah, I was just reading
that. And that's the shift from being an opponent of bureaucracy to being an opponent of communism, and how it's actually, if you think about it in those terms, it's actually not that difficult to make sense of.
Right.
And also, David Horowitz, I wrote down a quote of his. It relates to this, even though it's actually about something else. But he said that without the faith in the revolutionary future, I was nothing. And I feel like that just speaks to the what you said before, Ben, the deeply religious experience of becoming a communist.
Yeah,
right.
Especially if you were actually like an active party member, you had assignments, you moved, you dedicated your life to this cause because you felt it had some kind of redemptive quality, but like there was, the apocalypse, the revolution.
Yeah.
Right.
And so one more time, Deutscher says, can the intellectual now really just become a detached observer?
Mm.
It's like, no, of course not. So it actually makes a lot of sense that a person who was going to become a communist and live as a communist and their entire essence was going to be fed and maintained by virtue of their being a communist.
Yeah.
They would have to become not just an ex-communist. An ex-communist, at least at that time, would almost necessarily, especially if they were of any, especially if they were men of letters, whatever, if they were writers of any kind, they would have to become partisans of the right because they would have to find some new messianic mission.
Exactly. So, and that's sort of one of the things that I think a dialectical pessimism inoculates against is that sort of thing. Right. If you divorce Marxism from this view of inevitability, mm-hmm. right, and reinsert human agency back into the process, then it makes apostasy that much more unthinkable. Because right. I think if you think about the revolution as a historical inevitability, realizing that Marx was wrong about historical inevitability, or ignoring the caveat that he places in there about the common ruin of the contending classes, right? Just going all in on that historical inevitability the way that Trotskyists and Marxist-Leninists generally tend to do, mm-hmm. Means that once you're disillusioned with once you come to the realization that there is no historical inevitability, or if there was, that the window has passed, and I guess Marx was wrong, and I guess Lenin was wrong, or whatever people the realization that people come to, then it doesn't fucking matter, right? And if on top of all of that, you've got the idea in your head that the other camp that I've been fighting against for so long at least allows me for me to make a living doing whatever I want to do and allows for freedom of speech of some sort.
Right.
Then it becomes very easy to see. It becomes very easy to become an apostate. And it becomes easy for us to see why these people become apostates. So I think that a big fundamental component of this apostasy is disillusionment with the historical inevitability of the revolution.
Right. And as Deutscher puts it, the ex-communists you're alluding to remains a sectarian.
In a real sense.
He remains a sectarian. Yeah. He is an inverted Stalinist.
Right.
So out of fidelity to communism, they betray communism, right? The root of evil goes deeper than they thought, right? It's worth reading Deutscher at some length. Having broken with a party bureaucracy in the name of communism, the heretic goes on to break with communism itself. He claims to have made the discovery that the root of evil goes far deeper than he first imagined, even though his digging for that root may have been very lazy and very shallow. He no longer defends socialism from unscrupulous abuse. He now defends mankind from the fallacy of socialism. He no longer throws out the dirty water of the Russian Revolution to protect the baby. He discovers that the baby is a monster and which must be strangled. The heretic becomes a renegade. So that's like the specific type of apostate we're honing in on is the renegade. Yeah. Yeah.
So next on our list of iterations, after we have like the defections from official communist parties, a lot of those defections, like specifically around the around Stalinism, go into Trotskyist groups. They defect from Stalinism to Trotskyist groups. And I don't think we really see anyone defecting from Stalinism straight into being a conservative.
Well, there's Whitaker Chambers.
Whitaker Chambers. Okay. But you're right.
That's the Chambers Hiss, you know, the Alger Hiss trial. I think his journey, there's supposedly this like magisterial bio on him by Sam Tannenhaus that I'd like to read, but there's a period of time where he's kind of just laying low, I guess. And then once that the HUAC gets up and moving, or maybe it's in the late 40s, early 50s, after he's broken with the party, because he was, Whitaker Chambers was actually involved in espionage. Delivering messages from the State Department to emissaries of the Soviet
Union. Yeah.
And Alger Hiss was his comrade, a closeted communist. And there was this whole liberal defense of him saying he was never that, but he actually was. And they had a great falling out. And Hiss was one of those who gave him information. I miss Kevin. I wish he was here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need that third worldist position, you know, to round things out. Because we're about to get into the Maoists, which I know nothing about.
Interestingly, most of these political apostates go from official communist party to Trotskyist to political apostate, because I don't consider it's not really political apostasy to go from switching from the official communist party once a different leadership takes over to a different kind of communist party. There's still that communist ethos involved. There's just, especially within the, the Orthodox Trotskyist groups who are just like, well, we just need to reform the Soviet Union. We just need to reform these degenerated worker states, regenerate these degenerated worker states, right?
Right.
There's still like an ultimate belief in the project of communism.
Right.
With the Trotskyists, especially what it seems like is all of these Trotskyists who go to becoming apostates, become the neocons, the State Department socialists, etc. They come from Third Campist groups almost exclusively.
Right.
Right. Now, you'll have to forgive me here. I don't know of many Marxist-Leninists, other than Whitaker Chambers. I don't really know of many apostates from Marxism-Leninism at this time.
Well, not to the right, but there were plenty of ex-communists, right, who left the communist movement. It's just they didn't
become... Okay, yeah. Tons left. Tons, especially around the Prague Spring and the Hungarian Revolution. But Maoists, I know that they exist because I know that there are tons of former Maoists that ended up being liberals and conservatives. Right. I know like Van Jones, right? He's one. He's a former Maoist.
Gene Kwan, you know?
Like all of the Weathermen.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah. And then Maoist adjacent groups like the Black Panthers, who were sort of Maoist, but kind of just their own thing.
Right. Eldridge Cleaver. He's one.
Eldridge Cleaver for one. And then what's her name? She's a big sort of just shit lib now, who writes a lot about the carceral state.
What is her name?
You're not talking about Angela Davis, are you?
Yes, yeah. Angela Davis.
I wouldn't call her a shit lib. I think she's worshipped by shit libs.
I definitely would.
Well, that's fine.
No, I would definitely call her shit lib.
I would call her that because
her insistence that if your ideals are in any way informed by a kind of revolutionary fantasy, then you have to vote for insert whatever Democrat is at the top of the ticket right now.
Yeah, functionally shit-livery. Right.
Yeah.
Which is essentially the DSA's function in the past couple election cycles is shit-livery.
That's a broad. That's a very broad category of shit-livery, though. I feel like I like to reserve it for especially shit-livery.
Okay, so sure, but I would say liberal then.
Liberal, Angela Davis is a liberal. Liberal, I think, is okay. I mean,
yeah,
understandable.
She's not like an Elizabeth Warren stan or anything like that. She's liberal in that she thinks that voting matters, right?
Right. Well, she did endorse Barack Obama, I think.
Yeah. I mean, she's a liberal.
Yeah, if I was going to make this outline differently, I would not have divided exactly in Trotskyist, Marxist-Leninist, and Maoist, because I think a better way to do it, I mean, it kind of roughly still fits that schema, but there's a better way to maybe think of it is like the three historical moments that those terms represent.
That's true.
So like,
yeah,
Trotskyist, it's really, that's old communist, like old school Bolshevik inspired kind of socialist. And that's one kind of apostate.
Yeah.
When they stop being that, they start to be in the Cold War, especially in the 50s and 60s, that's a different kind of apostate, because those are the kind of ex-communists that Deutscher was talking about, the men of letters and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't make nearly as much of an impact beyond writing books like The God That Failed. And then the Maoists, a better way, rather than saying Maoist, a better generalized term would just be the former New Leftists, ex-student radicals from the 60s and 70s. And so that's people like David Horowitz and Norman Podhoretz and so on. That's kind of what I was thinking when I made this.
I would interject about the men of the writers who contributed to The God That Failed. I do think like Arthur Koestler is one of them, and his novel Darkness at Noon played a huge role in sort of, I guess, initiating people that weren't privy to the crimes of Stalinism, who weren't anti-communist yet, whatever, and people who had come from that or were straddling that. I do think that these artists played a huge role, and that's why so much was invested in them and in their testimonies.
I don't mean to suggest that they're insignificant. I just mean that there's a severe difference in their trajectories.
Yes.
Like, there's a reason why James Burnham and Max Schachtman stand out.
Yes.
As making such an enormous contribution, basically creating the entire world of conservatism that we now know today.
It's crazy. It's really crazy. It's really crazy to read. So a lot of these figures, their children and grandchildren are now at the helm, right? Of the conservative movement that we exist in, we are watching evolve today. It's amazing. I mentioned earlier, like what a linchpin Israel Palestine became for the fledgling neocons. I know we'll get into that in a minute, but just to define, like, so there's apostasy writ large. What are the parameters? We have party members, Fourth International members, etc., who cross over into liberal democracy, anti-communist leftism.
And those are the people that have the same kind of fire. They basically have to create the opposite of their messianic journey that they were once on the left in that,
but,
you know, apocalyptic messianic way.
Yeah.
When they come over to the right, they have to take that same kind of black and white view of the world. They just have to switch colors. Instead of being white, now they're black or whatever.
Right.
And then you have the difference between anti-Stalinist and anti-communist, which is very large, but missing for a lot of people. And then you have the people that go all the way, like Burnham and Schachtman. So there's a book, for instance, written by, it's referenced in one of the articles we read. I think it was the the New Yorker piece by George Packer. He's, or maybe it was the Tannen House, whichever. They're reviewing this book from 2017 by Daniel Oppenheimer called Exit Right. And I think it's interesting because the parameters for him, okay, so he's got Whitaker Chambers and James Burnham. The other instances of apostate in this book are Ronald Reagan, Pud Horowitz, and Christopher Hitchens. So there's this kind of like messy, muddy parameter of what it means, right?
Right.
Yeah, because Ronald Reagan, a former New Deal liberal, is not really an ex-communist.
Yeah.
He's kind of outside of the furthest reaches of what we're talking about, really.
Of course. But that is still a definition of apostasy and within like liberalism, right? And so, right. And so now when you get further to our lifetimes, all of this has just been, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, all of this has just been smushed together. You know, it's like...
Well, right. That's kind of why I was, when I was explaining the Maoist as a term on this outline, is actually former New Leftist, really, because that's the period in which being a leftist and being a liberal
right.
are basically the same thing, you know?
So... There was an article that you shared, Ben. The very last one that popped up, which was written by liberals about political apostasy.
Well, the liberal left. It was from In These Times, which has recently reclaimed its socialist bona fides, I guess. But yeah,
it's, has it?
Well,
couldn't tell from that article.
At least explicitly, the way it markets itself.
So that article was all about how like a bunch of people who were on the squishy, vaguely sort of left of the regular liberal left
right.
became too cozy with right wingers without ever having given up any of their liberal principles, and they consider that political apostasy.
Right.
Like people like Matt Taibbi, who, you know, never was much of a leftist anyways, kind of more libertarian-ish.
Right.
Going over to the right, which I don't think he ever actually went over to the right.
No.
He just sides with the right on free speech issues. Anyway, so like there is some coziness that is not a good look on behalf of people like Taibbi with, you know, I don't know who it was like, was it Tucker Carlson? Like, and the people like Jimmy Dore, people like that who never were part of the left, all these people who never were part of the left, who have gone over to be way too cozy with the right, but haven't actually gone full right. And that's what the whole article was about. Then there was like a bunch of stuff in there about how like, leftists who, like class first leftists are also political apostates because right. they're basically right wingers and stuff like that. So it's funny.
I think that has to be recognized as an entirely different discussion, which is also, it's a valuable one, but it has to be pushed to the side for now. I feel
right.
like.
Right. But okay. And so just to be clear, like people like Jimmy Dore and Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi.
Yeah.
They were never on the left to begin with. And they're still not. And now they're too cozy with people on the right. Yeah, I agree. They're too cozy. I don't consider that to be political apostasy. These are people that are like media figures that are trying to make a buck and they got canceled by the stupid part of the left and are going elsewhere to try to find people that will allow them to keep making money as media figures.
Right. Whereas like Leszek Kolakowski.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
He was a Polish communist. I think he's Polish, right?
Polish. Yes.
And he wrote a lot, but he wrote a actually kind of handy 2-volume Main Currents of Marxism.
3-volume.
It's very good.
Three volume. Yeah, that's right. It is 3 volumes. And it's good, even though it's also wrong on some very critical things. But if you read it with that in mind, it could be very educational because he's basically trying to justify his placement in a new part of the world outside of the communist way of interpreting and experiencing the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's just so much different from someone like Jimmy Dore.
Right. But I know we're going to shelve this, but I'm glad you bring it up. And that's why I shared it, because the whole framing of political apostasy left to right in this very small parameters, it kind of divulges the quote-unquote left's misconception of itself and of what liberalism is and of what being anti-capitalist is. Like, the fact that they didn't realize Glenn Greenwald was a libertarian this whole fucking time. You know, when we saw him speak at the socialism conference fucking 15 years ago, he was a libertarian. The fact that they don't understand there are causes that cross over and there are different kinds of progressive, you know, things that we are going to be aligned with all sorts of people. That's not apostasy. And that's why I thought this article was like a good thing to share.
They also called Max Blumenthal a political apostate because... because he went from being what to what? He's just an ML. He's still an ML, right?
Right. So what that is that's an admission of a certain sense, anyways. An admission of how whatever is currently I don't want to say in vogue. I don't want to be so dismissive, but let's say whatever currently dominates the discourse is the actual.
Well, I think whatever you're trying to say could perhaps be. I could say the same thing by mentioning that they include Dave Chappelle, Roseanne, and Russell Brand in this in this body of examples. There's just a misconceived notion of, I guess, the ideological spectrum.
Right. Because this is what I was trying to say. The difference is that in the past, we're dealing with like Irving Kristol and like Sidney Hook. We're talking about what it means to be a communist is to be in the Communist Party. To support the program of the party and to advocate for not just roughly just kind of vaguely defined ideas and positions on an individual basis, the program of the Communist Party and by extension, the Communist International and so on. Versus today, what people are talking about is like, I don't really like how that guy makes me feel individually because he says a thing that I don't think already. That's just, it's an entirely different phenomenon.
I guess that Max Blumenthal, as an ML when he was younger, got away with being perceived as left, like a left liberal because he wrote for The Nation and stuff like that. So like him being like an anti-imperialist who, is so anti-imperialist that he's actually pro-Putin is a sort of political apostasy to liberals.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, disclaimer, Putin bad. Okay. Moving on. Fucking morons. So back to the outline here. I think we kind of jumped around all over the place just now because of me.
Really? Oh yeah, because you took us to that article.
Yeah. So like where the section that we should be at is how they shaped the Cold War.
Yeah.
The first group of political apostates that we're talking about are the ones who go into the State Department and who become like writers that anti-communist writers who help shape Cold War policy. And I believe that Whitaker Chambers is like becomes friends with Avril Harriman, and Avril Harriman is the author of the or one of the authors of the containment policy that was implemented by, you know, Eisenhower and Truman.
Right.
So,
which is actually the ideological basis and justification for getting involved in Vietnam.
Right.
But that doesn't cut the mustard for the fledgling neocons. Containment is too defensive, you know.
Right.
There's this. I don't know how conspiratorial this is, but the linking of neoconservative foreign policy to the Likudnik papers. It was very interesting.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking of George Kennan, not Avril Harriman. George Kennan was another Cold Warrior who was an advocate of containment policy. He was the Undersecretary of State and George Kennan was the what was he? Ambassador to the Soviet Union, and became anyway. So like, yeah, George Kennan and Avril Harriman, and but I think it was George Kennan who was friends with Whitaker Chambers at some point. And then Whitaker Chambers actually got a medal, a Presidential Medal of Freedom, from Ronald Reagan, right?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So but anyway, these people,
I have to recognize that their contributions were sort of important, if not pivotal, you know?
Yeah.
They were at least recognized by, you know, like you just said, by people like Reagan, where if you were going to try to personify the Cold War, I don't think you could do a better job than Reagan.
So the
partially because of the myth of how much he actually personifies our side of the Cold War.
Right.
But okay, so we have during the 50s, the Red Scare and the House of Un-American Activities Committee is really given a boon from the God That Failed crowd, from the ex-communist testimony. Especially in that, just to remind everyone that HUAC was extra legal in its entirety. So it was entirely about it was entirely a show trial. And so it was about these professions of lapsed faith, and about hearing from the apostate that would be courageous enough to tell his testimony and so forth. So,
which is also very critical for dramatically weakening and neutering American labor, especially.
Yes, right.
Especially right after World War II. Like there's the twin phenomenon of the Taft-Hartley Act and the cancellation of Operation Dixie.
Mm. Yeah.
Those two things are really only possible to understand if you can contextualize those phenomena with the abundance of ex-communists.
And what the ex-communists, as the neocons later will do, is they provide to the establishment credulity to the witch hunt, to HUAC, of this sussing out. They remind the body politic that this is real. This is not just right-wing opportunists, because we have been there and we've seen it, and we're not all right-wingers now, and so forth. And so you have all the State Department socialists that Chris was bringing up, wielding and weaponizing this spectacle to enact Taft-Hartley and so on.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to even imagine that possibility. Like, they couldn't pass Taft-Hartley at the height of the New Deal, because there would not have been enough support. There would have been major protests against it. But then after the war, after, you know, all of these confessions of ex-communists, after the Smith Act and so on, it becomes it's a lot easier anyways.
I think we can move to how they impacted the left, right?
Well, I think we should also just fill in. So there's the Cold War is a long period of time, right? So once the traditional conservative wing is kind of usurped from within by the neocons. I mean, do we want to tell briefly, can we tell the story of the neocons?
Yeah, let's do that.
So one of the interesting things is how in our era, paleocons, gripes about neocons is almost a euphemism of anti-Semitism, because so many of the neocons were Jewish ex-Trotskyists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that Irving Kristol being the pretty much credited with being the founder of neoconservatism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And neoconservatism, it wasn't like a break with whatever social democracy. It initiated itself in the beginning to try and reform the Democratic Party, right? To try and hold off, be a battery to the new left and all of what they perceived as totally crazy and the McGovern kind of policy. Seeding the contest, quitting. They didn't just want containment. They wanted to basically be more offensive, which gets us later on after the Carter years. They voted for Carter for the most part and were supremely disappointed. And this is when they break with the Democratic Party and become Reaganites. And this is when they basically, there's this argument I don't know enough about, that their policy initiatives are mirroring those espoused by the Likud Party in Israel, which is basically trying to change the region to Israel's favor. And this is around the time when the Cold War, all questions about policy towards the Soviet Union can be answered by how does it affect Israel? And I feel very strange. I feel like I want to do more investigation of this, but that's quite something.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really funny that like neoconservatives in the 1960s and 70s are essentially just what the mainstream Democratic Party is now.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what the neoconservatives were aiming to create. They rejected the Great Society programs. They wanted a muscular foreign policy that went after the bad guys. And then when they switched over, when the neoconservatives became conservatives and switched to the, not when they became conservatives, when the neoconservatives switched to become Republicans, because the party that they were trying to build already existed in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party just caught up to them.
Yep.
And became what they were trying to do the entire time.
Right.
It's really funny and interesting. And you can see here where Irving Kristol's third campism, how it morphs and changes into his neoconservatism. Because he was a third camp Trotskyist. I don't remember what group he was part of.
He was a YPSL.
Yeah, YPSL, Young People Socialist League.
Young People Socialist League. So he would have been a Schachtmanite.
Right. Okay. And then he becomes he basically is the progenitor of neoconservatism because he doesn't think that the Democrats are anti-communist enough. He sees Stalinism as the ultimate evil.
Right.
And the United States as the vehicle to fight Stalinism, and morphs into just this like demonic force in American politics.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's the necessary endpoint for third campism. Generally, it's just more annoying Trotskyism that doesn't matter. But
or else like a podcast where you just sit around and talk about how third campus guys, some of which have become neoconservatives.
Yeah, there we go. The inevitable result of third campism is to become annoying podcasters.
So in answer to, I mean, how they shaped the Cold War, they shifted foreign policy from containment to active destabilization.
Right.
And
that's actually a pretty big shift.
And that doesn't just that changes the world. That basically defines the world we live in. Like in that one, I think The Legacy of the Trotskyite Right, which is written by someone who sounds like a paleocon to me, Snigowski. He says
that's a paleocon name.
He says they actually altered the content of conservatism to their liking, and I think in effect, in doing so, they altered liberalism writ large.
Yes.
So they
like Elizabeth Warren could not be seen as a basically like Bernie Sanders, a little bit less radical than Bernie Sanders, without first the insane kind of a shakeup of what it meant to be a conservative.
No, I heard recently that Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton are apostates, political apostates that went from right to left. So you're wrong.
They're political apostates that went from right to other side of right.
Now, I was actually just listening to something about this, and those were some of the few examples.
That's a terrible example.
I mean, I suppose if I was to be really generous, I could, in a very not very useful way, see that Warren has evolved in some way. I think Hillary Clinton It's just an absurd, totally absurd example.
I feel like you would have to describe and define what you're even talking about, because I cannot imagine at all. Like Elizabeth Warren, in what way is she any different because of switching her party affiliation? Right.
Well, but that article we mentioned earlier, they referenced Joan Didion, which I think amounts to the same thing, because she was a Goldwater girl, you know, and then later she wrote some things that sounded kind of liberal, and liberals love her. So that's essentially what we're talking about.
Once you get rid of the whole spectrum and all you're left with is the one point, then you zoom in and you make a new spectrum within that one point.
Okay, so what are we doing now?
Well, we were just talking about how they shaped the Cold War, right? Anything further to say about that? I basically very quickly got us up to what amounts to the end of the Cold War. So if we want to move on.
Yeah, because we kind of already talked about the conversion experience and the taking the, you know, the messianism and switching sides, but maintaining the same kind of a, you can't just become nothing. You can't just become a, you can't go from being a prophet to just being a nihilist. So you have to be a prophet of something else. But I think we already covered that.
Hmm.
So yeah. What about how they impacted the left?
Well, I mean, there's all the ways we talked about the sort of, the ways that policy, devastated it through things like Taft-Hartley.
Just like severe weakening and also kind of pretty demoralizing effects too. Like knowing that so many, people that you would build themselves leading lights now anyways, you know, that was a place that was the thing that could happen. I can say from experience that turns out to have been kind of demoralizing, not so totally, but you know, it has a little bit of a dampening effect anyways.
Yeah, I think there's like the direct sort of state movement and then state-driven legal and structural weakening of the left. And then there's like all of the residual and indirect ways in which it just becomes, it loses its meaning and it doesn't seem worth being a part of. And it just starts diminishing.
Well,
and that's in tandem with the failures of the Comintern, right? So they always have a great dancing partner with the Comintern.
Well, and in the case of someone like Schachtman, the long-term effects are the not just defanging, but actually the dismantling of the Socialist Party and the creation of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Right.
Which is not like a reassertion of the left wing of the Socialist Party. It's actually, we're going to be socialists and we're not going to give up on the whole thing, but we are going to adopt all the characteristics of giving up, but we're still going to be socialists.
Did you guys know that Michael Harrington actually coined the term neoconservatives?
Yeah, I saw that. That's kind of funny.
When they were still in the Democratic Party, so.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because he needed there to be not liberals because he needed to make the Democratic Party something that could still be captured and saved or whatever.
Oh, man.
Which is funny because, like, if you really look at people like Robert McNamara and, like, the people that Kennedy brought into his administration to run things, like all the whiz kids, you know, that were so anti-communist that they actually didn't give a shit about the welfare state at all. In as much as they needed to keep it around to keep them getting reelected, that I don't see how they're very much different than, you know, the neoconservatives.
Right.
There might be some nuances that I'm missing because this is not something that I study in depth or anything. But
But if you think about it, the liberal, the real liberal that everyone always talks about and that everyone's always trying to like reassert is actually just the New Deal.
Yeah.
And it's the product of communist influence.
Right.
It's not at all. The neoliberal way of thinking is actually just, that's how liberals are. That's more, how they always have been.
More accurate
with the one exception of the time in which they had to pacify the communists.
Right.
Well, I was going to say more accurately than to say communist influence is the looming threat of communism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But then a lot
think about Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
Like when he was a little kid, he would, with his family around the dinner table, they would pray for the victory of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And also, he's with one of the great progressive presidents. That's what it means to be an actual liberal.
He famously screened, Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith in the White House.
Yep.
Everyone knows that. On top of that, he his idea of the robust foreign policy that would secure freedom around the world is very much so what the neoconservatives espouse as well.
It's identical.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Essentially, the neoconservatism is just an attempt to reassert, to get things back on track, after this whole sideshow of the New Deal and the Great Society.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which is basically, Great Society was expounding upon the New Deal, essentially.
It's just an attempt to get rid of the Popular Front.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Yeah.
Well, apparently the neocons, at least initially, before they became absorbed into the right wing establishment, they supported the modern welfare state.
But not the expansion of the modern welfare state. Like opposed the Great Society programs, but they favored keeping the Social Security, et cetera. Right.
Right.
Yeah, because those programs were there when they were little, when they were younger.
Whatever. Right.
Yeah.
So
that's all.
So they were trying. Yeah, you're right. So, but later on, the neoconservatives that I were around when I was a kid that invaded Iraq, that had transformed and had absorbed a lot of paleocon ideals. And but initially, there was a real usurpation of the sort of traditional libertarian small government kind of conservatism.
And then, I mean, you sort of get like within this neoconservatism that's sort of based around foreign policy and cracking down on communism at home. Yeah. Famously, Irving Kristol is said to have advocated suspending First Amendment rights for communists. Right.
God.
But through the process, these neoconservatives get folded into the neoliberal project, right? They adopt the neoliberal project as part of what defines neoconservatism and help that take over the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So there's the hardcore conservatives that get Reagan elected who were who would have previously been isolationists, but who were so anti-communist that they became neoconservatives. They would probably be considered among the libertarian right by our standards, right? The old school conservatives that were around the Mannion Forum and the National Review whenever that first came about. But of course, Buckley was a pragmatist and wanted to be as appealing to mainstream conservatives as possible.
Right.
So he had lots of viewpoints in the National Review and on the firing line. He would have liberals come on and debate him on the firing line.
Yeah.
He would have
Ginsburg come on and
yeah, exactly. Or Gore Vidal.
Or Noam Chomsky.
Gore Vidal, who famously called William F. Buckley the F slur for gay people.
Oh, man. He was good.
I did not know about that.
Yeah, he said he was talking about how he was reading Buckley's writing, and he says, "It sounded like a blank wrote this." what a bunch of blanketry, And Buckley is famously a closeted homosexual, and Gore Vidal is famously not closeted.
Right.
Homosexual. But anyway, yeah, Gore Vidal is great.
Yeah.
Where was I going with this?
Well, we were talking about the evolution, the morphing of
There are like multiple strands that all come together. Like, we wouldn't recognize neoconservatism in its initial instantiation as being neoconservatism. We would just, like, I think we've said this like a half a dozen times already. We would just call that like being a Democrat. But it gets combined with through its evolution to adopt neoliberalism as part of its economic outlook, and then gets morphed into what we now know as neoconservatism.
Yeah.
So it's like it when you think like what the hell do people mean when they say the Trotskyists founded neoconservatism? Like, how is that even that doesn't make any sense. And in my mind, whenever I first started hearing this in the early 2000s, whenever I was a Trotskyist, I would think I just don't understand how these people could just go fall off so hard. But like, if you understand what neoconservatism actually was in its first instantiation, it's not that crazy of a leap.
Right.
Yeah.
And it follows from a series of logical decisions that are made when you reach a crux in the road. I was looking at this. So I mentioned that book by Daniel Oppenheimer, which I do think I will read, even though he includes Ronald Reagan among his portraits. But he says stories of apostasy are worth telling because it's during the period of political transition when the bones of one's belief system are broken and poking out through the skin that the contingency and complexity of belief becomes most visible. And I think that's a very poignant way of putting what I said at the top of the episode about why I think this is worth investigating, because these are the broken bones of belief, and we can sort of see inside, we can see beyond the veil in ways we might not be able to when it is intact.
There's something I wanted to talk about. Now, this is actually political apostasy is actually something that has come up quite a bit in left circles in the past few years, where with figures like Amy Therese and Dasha and Anna from Red Scare.
Yeah, they were profiled in These Times article.
Angela Nagel, people like that. People that were considered leftists at some point and then switched over. And that, to me, is a third type of apostasy. There are a half a dozen other sort of like minor left-ish celebrities that became political apostates. And I think that like a lot of people like to lump Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald in with this group, but I think it's a different group altogether. I think Matt Taibbi, Jimmy Dore, Glenn Greenwald were never really on our side to begin with. I mean, Jimmy Dore was what, a fucking comedian? Who gives a shit? Like, they're comedians.
They're civil libertarians.
Yeah, they're civil libertarians, and they end up making alliances with bad people because they don't have political principles really outside of, free speech absolutism or whatever. And then people like Amy Therese and the Red Scare girls, that's a little bit different. Yeah. They claimed some sort of Marxism or a socialist politics at some point and then became reactionaries, like Amy Therese being sympathetic to fascism as a curative to the insanity of woke leftism. And then the Anna and Dasha just being like,
they're just taking that teal money and running for it.
Well, yeah. I've heard some people just describe that as trying to stay relevant.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like,
but I mean, they're having Curtis Yarvin on and talking for hours. You know, it's like, it's
yeah. I feel like there's more to it than just trying to stay relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think what it is like, it's an edgelordism that I think becomes sincere in the attempt to because whenever Red Scare was, it was on the left and it had a space on the left where it was like part of the dirtbag left, where they would say things that most leftists weren't okay with saying. They would say, like, they would call people retards and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's just like they would say things that were not okay. They would refer to women they didn't like as fat, stupid bitches, or, you know, things that were completely unacceptable on the left, on the mainstream yeah. left. So they were like edgy and yeah. still transgressive, but, and also anti-establishment. But I think that the edgelordism sort of like took them to a place where, like, once it quit being edgy to say that sort of things, and they weren't constantly stirring up controversy around them being the leftists that called people retards, then they moved into like more transgressive territory and more transgressive territory. Because I remember every once in a while I would go check out Red Scare just to see like what everybody was mad about. And they had a woman on who's her whole thing was that she does performance art where she reads rape jokes to the crowd. And I was just like, what's the fucking point of this? Like, just to piss people off. That's all this is for. Just trying to piss people off to stay relevant. And then, you know, I think that, like, there's been several accusations, which I think are probably not too far off the mark. They started taking Peter Thiel money to have people like Alex Jones and Steve Bannon on. And it became profitable to be transgressive.
Yeah.
In a way that they weren't being really transgressive in. So, I mean, I think that this is all speculation on my part, but this kind of apostasy is born from being too fucking online.
Yeah.
And it's irony posting and edgelordism. And that's Amy Therese. That's, you know, Red Scare. That's I don't think that's Angela Nagel. I think Angela Nagel tried to make a point, didn't do a super good job of it, and got drummed out of the left, and then doubled down on being what everybody said she was.
Right.
Yeah, I kind of think that what you're calling the third iteration,
yeah,
right,
of political apostasy, yeah,
is about as ridiculous as the left itself is.
Well, yes, it's exactly. It's the first is tragedy, then is farce, and then this third time, which is just like,
well, because what it is it's. What happens to tragedy with what happens to farce when tragedy is sublated through it?
Exactly. There we go.
It's the newest iteration of a thing, which is the unity of these two previous iterations.
Exactly. It's funny because we start out talking about James Burnham, and to give the gravity of that defection. To talk about the gravity of that defection as compared to fucking the girls with the podcast that has a girl's thong on it,
yeah,
in the thumbnail, to talk about them in the same conversation seems like a fucking joke, and it is.
A joke. Well, but it would be the same as if we were talking about like Trotsky as a person, and then also whatever the hell is happening with the. IMT right now.
Yeah.
I feel like, so this third iteration of this dime square nonsense, it's like you said, like they have allowed themselves to be wholly defined by their cancelers and have wrapped themselves in that garb. And now the parameters of apostasy are just wokeism and anti-wokeism. And they're full bore anti-wokeism, and the rest doesn't really matter. Like, it's just pick and choose. That's why you can have Mencius Molebug on and listen to all his nonsense about fucking monarchy and like pretend to take yourself seriously, because the real point is to be provocative. But like, I know people don't really care for John Gans, but in these Times article, he talks about how he's speaking about the dime square. The problem is they have to keep coming up with stuff to be provocative. And like you said, Chris, they're running out. This is basically what they wind up in, this last remaining cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
Who's still listening to them that started off when they were on the left? Like, they just have to court an audience. I don't really think, I mean, I don't know how many people are in this sort of orbit, but I doubt that it's very big.
I don't know anyone. I don't even like I knew like a guy that I knew who was a former rightist who like was kind of drawn into the post left circles because he was just like, look, I don't want to be an alt-right loser anymore. But these, you know, these Red Scare chicks kind of make sense, you know, like being drawn into that sort of milieu. He was the last person I knew to take Red Scare seriously. And I've listened to the show on several occasions. I've never really cared much for Dasha's contributions on anything. But like Anna to me always seemed smart, but she also had really just stupid takes that were born from just trying to be provocative, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I would listen every once in a while just to see, like, what are all the most annoying people in the world freaking out about this week, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the problem is that the most annoying people in the world were the ones that were fueling their popularity. Because nobody ever listened to them because they thought they were cool. They listened to them because they thought they were transgressive.
Yeah. So you introduce a new, I guess, category in this third iteration of political apostasy, which is the post left. And this is where we have journals like Compact. And we have this weird fusion between disaffected leftists and rightists, uniting around some weird amalgamated social democracy, right?
I mean, it's not really, it's mostly uniting around anti-wokeism because you've got people like, I think Compact at one point, I was looking through their website, and I think at one point they had a contribution by a conservative senator. He's one of the more right-wing ones.
Josh Hawley.
Josh Hawley. There we go. Yeah. They had Josh Hawley write for Compact, who is 100% a fucking free market fundamentalist.
Right.
And then you've got people who I think contribute to it that are – the only thing that they have in common with some of the right wingers on there is that they're anti-woke, like Ashley Frohley, right? Who's a contributor to Zero, or was a contributor to Zero Books, his podcast and stuff like that, and is now part of Sublation Media. And then even Slavoj Žižek has written for Compact at some point.
Slavoj Žižek.
Actually, Žižek has written for Compact as recently as last month.
Yeah, so really the only thing that ties all of these Compact people together is the anti-wokeness or whatever. And Malcolm Kayun or whatever, the apostate from the Swedish Marxist left that Mir hates so much. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I remember him talking about him and who became like, who is still a self-proclaimed Marxist, but is like, affiliated with one of their anti-immigrant conservative parties now.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, that whole thing is bound up in anti-wokeness. And I don't even necessarily know if they have any other unifying principles outside of that.
There's a very thin veneer, even from the likes of Hawley, at least he espouses a kind of very thin vestige of pro-labor it's almost might as well not even be stated, but it does set him apart from his party in some minor way.
Well, right, because what we're really talking about is the absolute absence of a meaningful, like when we say left, like what do we even mean? Like in the absence of a communist party and in the absence of even like broad and vaguely defined kind of social movements, what we actually have to pass for a left is just a collection of individuals, you know, self-consciousness. And it's like the lowest form of identity is a self-identity.
Right.
So what you have is you have a bunch of different individual selves that they cannot group together on any basis other than the fact that they don't like one vague kind of cultural question. What does it mean to be anti-woke? It means a lot of things, and it means a different thing depending on your individual self-conception of what it means to be anti-woke.
Yeah. And ultimately, it doesn't matter.
No.
Well, right.
None of this shit matters. Like, all of these people that we're talking about are so fucking inconsequential. I'm not saying that, like, comparatively inconsequential, right? Because, like you reiterated several times in the last podcast, is everything matters, right? to a certain extent, everything matters. But these people are like so comparatively inconsequential when we look at people like, you know, Burnham and Whitaker Chambers and, you know, Irving Kristol.
Well, yeah, because Burnham was having to contend with the fact that what his former self, a person like Burnham, could potentially lead the working class to overthrow capitalists because they had some successes in that direction.
Right.
And the former leftists today, they have to find a different audience so they can continue to make, I don't want to say
to make an impact somehow, like on the internet. Yeah. You know, whatever. I would say that, like,
what they need to do is they need to continue to find validation. Sure. That's what they need.
And like some podcasters that used to be socialist adjacent are now right wing adjacent or right wing, whatever. Who gives a shit?
Right.
Like a person that wrote a book is no longer writing a book anymore. Like that's the stakes now. Right.
Right. Whereas like Milovan Djilas, you know, he like led the Yugoslav partisans and founded the Yugoslav Socialist Republic and was like a critical part of the communist leadership of the world for many years. Right. And him becoming a switching sides or drifting toward the other side, that actually matters in a quantitatively different sense.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And his conversations with Stalin had a seismic effect too.
Yeah. I read that book. It's wild.
It's kind of like, like the secret the Khrushchev speech. It kind of has a similar effect in quarters. I feel like so I've been thinking as you've been talking about this about the way. So we were talking about the neoconservative movement and how it sort of was really ascendant during the Reagan years and then got us up to its, I don't know. Let's say Bush 2 is where we had the War on Terror, which is its legacy for most people. And now, because that was such a disaster, now we have this moment of Trump, which is in the same way that neoconservatism absorbed paleoconservatism, Trump is absorbing all these varying contradictions in opportunistic ways, espousing protectionism, espousing different kinds of, statism, while being neoliberal, while being, it's like, so I think that's where all of these things that don't seem to matter downriver end up emerging in the strange, in the strange cabinet that he had. There's a lot of strange, unorthodox ideas that shape policy that were totally heretical, just 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
As far as I don't know. I don't. That's maybe a feel outside of what we're talking about. But I do think we're in a strange shaking up of at least the way the right positions itself politically.
So, what we're finding now, just to bring things full circle and put a bow on all of this, is that we have a movement started by former Trotskyists who became liberals, who tried to turn the liberal party, the Democrats, more conservative, and then wholesale joined the conservative party, and in turn turned both parties into a different kind of conservative. And because of the figure of Trump, there's been a rupture within the Republican Party, which is now comprised of neocons and paleocons, and a Democratic Party who's absorbing those same neocons who split from the Democrats to go into the Republicans back into the fold.
Right.
If not officially, they're at least allies of them. And if you look at the way that like John Bolton and George Bush have been rehabilitated by liberals.
Right.
Exactly.
And those same liberals that have rehabilitated these heinous fucking ghouls now demand that we on the socialist left vote for them.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of socialists are going along with it.
They are.
Fewer now because of Gaza, but like still, I still see, nominally socialist friends of mine arguing for harm reduction and lesser evilism, even in the face of this, the slaughter of the wholesale fucking eradication of Palestinians that we're witnessing right now.
And the harm reduction is wholly hypothetical.
If we can hold him to a standard, then we can maybe have harm reduction.
Yeah, but meanwhile, the harm being enacted now by their guy is real and unfolding. It's like,
yeah.
So Gaza is the premier reason not to engage and follow this lesser evilism vote. Sorry, Ernie, quiet. But I mean, I was going to mention just a couple days ago, Biden goes down and Trump both go down to the border, right, and have their different conferences. And Biden, what does he do?
Yeah.
He says, "Mr. Trump, bring your MAGA. Let's work together to enact the best." Yeah. It's like, okay, so where's the harm reduction? Right? It's even beyond what you're talking about. I think we've reached a new phase of it, of like actually courting MAGA.
Well, the harm reduction, it's in as much as it is just theoretical, is also undefined because it's a memory. And it's not a memory of like, you know, when you like look through a photo album, you go, "Oh yeah, I remember when we went to the Grand Canyon in 1987. It's a memory of like over breakfast when you start to try to tell someone about your dream that you had. You woke up at like 3 a.m. and you had a dream and you remember sort of kind of vaguely some pieces of it, but you don't really remember what happened. That's the level of the kind of harm reduction in theory.
You were there and I think I might have been naked, but we were getting yelled at, dude. That's how those dreams are remembered.
Без нас некому будет установить порядок, определить работу, и нас все развалится, и все распадется.